Current State on 90.5 WKAR. Welcome back. President Obama visited Flint yesterday, of course, to hear firsthand about the city's ongoing water crisis. He was met by Governor Snyder and then traveled to the Food Bank of Eastern Michigan and to Flint's Northwestern High School for a neighborhood roundtable. Dale Wayhill is an administrator at Flint's Mott Community College and a former Flint City Council member. He was among those in attendance at one of the president's appearances.
To provide, hopefully, some hope for the community, letting us know sort of from a moral position that he's supportive of us. He's done that from Washington and other places, you know, as he's given speeches and talked about the Flint crisis, but it's different to hear it in person.
Later, President Obama spoke before a crowd of Flint residents at the city's Northwestern High School. He shared his hopes for Flint's coming days.
And to make sure that this proud city bounces back, not just to where it was, but stronger than ever. And I want all of you to know I am confident that Flint will come back.
Again, President Obama there with an update from his visit yesterday to Flint. I'm Mark Bayshore. This is Current State on WKAR. 10 days ago, the Lansing Board of Water and Light's computer network was struck by a malware attack that forced the utility to lock down its systems. The utility says that while dealing with the attack, customer services were not affected. They also say customer and employee data remained secure throughout the attack. So, what has the Lansing Board of Water and Light done to recover, and are operations back to normal? To learn more, we welcome Lansing Board of Water and Light General Manager Dick Peffley back to Current State. Hi, Dick.
Good morning, Mark.
On Monday of this week, you told the State Journal that you were getting closer to normal operations after restoring customer-related functions, and you said you expected employee email functions to return midweek. Can you give us an update?
Sure. As far as our customers are concerned out there, they can conduct business as usual with the BWL. Our email system, I'm hoping, will be up today. It was very close last night. We did some testing. That's the last major internal system that we need to be needs to be brought back online.
So if you were to look at this in terms of 100%, 0 to 100%, how close to 100% back to normal are you?
80%.
80, okay. It was reported that law enforcement is trying to locate the source of the attack. What do you know about that?
Well, yes, local, state, and federal law officials were brought in to assist us. They are conducting an investigation right now. They're no longer on site, but they're doing what they do behind the scenes, and we anxiously await a report from them.
The state police, FBI, and City of Lansing, LPD, are those the three that are involved?
Yes, those are the three that are assisting us through this.
Okay. How did your staff first learn about this? What did you see that told you something was wrong?
One of our employees came in Monday morning. It was probably about 5 in the morning and turned a computer on. And we are assuming they opened the email. We haven't finished that investigation yet. And their computer didn't operate properly. So they notified the IT department. IT looked into it and they saw that it was a malware type of virus. And they immediately started shutting the corporate network down so that it wouldn't spread through the entire network.
At its peak, How many of your systems did it impact? I mean, we know it impacted internal email and some customer service functions. At its worst, how much was affected?
Well, obviously, as you stated, it did not affect any of our employees or customers' data. That's all secure, remains secure. And our production facilities, our transmission distribution, our plants, nothing was compromised there. Our operations of our four utilities continued unhampered by this. But since we have over 750 employees, they all have access to computers and emails, we have to go through each one of those devices to see the extent of it. And we're finding about a 5 to 8% infection rate, but it's a daunting task to check every one of these pieces of equipment before we bring it back online.
And you're sure that credit card numbers, other personal information didn't get exposed?
Absolutely. We actually brought a third party in to verify that we didn't miss anything, just to so that our customers can rest assured their information was always secure and remains secure. That part worked for us.
There have been reports that this involved ransomware. A lot of people are curious about that. So far, you've declined to say whether it was ransomware or not. Can you tell us today if it was ransomware?
Nope, we're still not confirming or denying any of that. Since it's an ongoing criminal investigation, we've been advised not to comment. And I'll be honest with you, these people came into our house. They messed with the Borderline Light, and I'm going to do everything in my power to work with law enforcement to make sure we bring these perpetrators to justice.
So that's on the advice of the FBI or the state police that you not disclose?
All the above.
All of the above. In the past, I know we've had conversations here, lots of people in lots of workplaces get advised not to open suspicious emails or attachments. Has that advice been in circulation at the BWL?
Yes, it is, and we continue to educate new employees as well as existing ones to be careful when you open an attachment. But some of the attachments that we find that when we protect ourselves against opening it that don't get actually opened, they look just like a normal seminar or meeting invite that you would normally open and go to. So they're getting very sophisticated in how they try to attack your systems.
Mm-hmm. Dick Pethley is general manager of the Lansing Board of Water and Light. We're talking about the utility's efforts to return to normalcy after a malware attack on its computer systems last week. And Mr. Pethley says they're about 80% back, and they hope to restore personal email functions here, hopefully today. Talk about these IT experts that you're getting help from here. Who are they? How did the BWL come into contact with them?
They're a company that helps you restore from a cyber event, and we reached out to them. They come in with a contingency of about 20 people that look at your system. They take and tell you what they've seen, because they're dealing with this on a daily basis. This is the first time we've ever dealt with it, so we use their expertise. And another thing we've asked them to do is, could we have done something different? Can we have been better at this? You know, did we miss something? And we could have brought our system back in 2 or 3 days, but they said that you would be just as vulnerable as you were prior, even though you had state-of-the-art antivirus software. So they're helping us reconfigure our system, so if this happens in the future, we could be back in a matter of hours instead of days.
So I take it there's some concern that a virus might still be lurking somewhere in your computer system?
That was the concern, and that's why we're checking every device we have so that when we turn them back on, we know that they're secure.
Yeah. Are there ways of preventing these attacks in the future?
They told us you can minimize it, but there are 50 major software antivirus companies that we've reached out to. Only 3 of them had ever seen this virus before, and unfortunately, the one we dealt with hadn't seen it. So you have to plug every hole to keep somebody from breaking into your system. They only have to find one hole.
Mm-hmm. And now you put your recovery at about 80%. You're saying that the personal email function that has not been restored yet, that constitutes about 20% of the whole problem then?
Yes. Once we bring that back online, we have some small systems that are used once a month for maybe generating a report that we'll look at down the road that won't impact our employees' productivity. Email is the big one right now.
Okay. What is this? You've got plenty on your plate already here. I mean, what's it been like here for the past 10 days dealing with this for you? How much have you learned from this episode?
Very long hours, because the management team stands right beside the IT folks that are putting this back together. We're there to run interference, make sure there's no barrier. So a lot of hours, something that I've learned a lot about. I have definitely changed my password on my personal computer now to a much longer sequence of numbers.
Right.
I understand they can get into this stuff if they want to.
Can you identify the names of the companies, the IT companies that you're working with?
N1 Resource is one that we brought in.
N1
Resource.
The letter N, the number, N1.
Yeah. Okay. They are the main ones. They are helping us through this. They've been, they were recommended. This is an insurable loss for our company. So they were one of the companies, our insurance company, said that they've used in the past to help companies through this. And they've been very helpful getting us restored to this point.
Staying ahead of criminal elements here has got to be an ongoing concern, not just for you, but for anybody with a computerized system. How confident do you think you will be at staying ahead of this here in the future?
I have a much better feeling, but now that I know that if or when this happens again, that our recovery time is very short. That's the thing that helps us. We're talking a matter of hours. But I also had this company take a look at our power plants and our transmission and distribution system, our computers there, and they were very impressed with the controls we had in place there. So I sleep good at night knowing that those systems are secure.
At what point do you think you might be able to disclose whether it was ransomware or not?
When law officials give us the okay.
But do you have any idea how long that might be?
No, because I think that we're just a small piece in this. From what we can see, this has happened to companies everywhere, and you know that they're looking into this as a bigger issue than just the Board of Water and Light.
Let's move on to some other topics, because, as I say, there's a lot of other issues on your plate. Talk to us here about your plan for the substation at the current site of Scott Park here in Riotown. It's generated some resistance. Where does that stand?
Sure. We went through the Parks Board process and got approval there. It was a 5-3 vote, so it wasn't unanimous to move to the next step, which is the Planning Commission hearing. And that takes place on Tuesday, May 17th at 6:30 at the Neighborhood Empowerment Center over on 600 West Maple Street. So that's the next step in the process to go in front of those individuals. And if we are successful there, then it would move on at a later date to the City Council for the ultimate approval.
And remind us, Dick, what makes Scott Park the most desirable location as far as the utility is concerned?
Sure. The all the power that leaves the Eckert Power Station, or a third of it, is underground from Eckert to downtown. So we had to locate the substation along those wires. They're underground, the customers don't see them. And we looked at some other sites along there, and they just didn't work out. And we would love to build it anywhere but Scott Park, because it is generating some controversy. But it's where it has to land, and anywhere else would be a considerable increase in the capital budget to do it.
Are the people who are resisting, the people concerned with the history of the Scott House and the green space here at the Sunken Gardens, to what extent do you think they have a point?
Well, we understand their concerns. We have had meetings with anybody that wants to talk to us about this and suggestions. We're looking to lower the height of the walls, move them back, put in the fishing platforms in, the river walk. Anything that we can do to make the site more attractive to when it's completed is what we're looking to do right now. So their concerns do not go unnoticed to us.
And your figures suggest that building on the current Eckert site would add $13 million to the cost of replacing Eckert?
Yes, and it is not recommended because it's in a floodplain and you really don't want to build there. That puts you at risk of a flood. It's a flood if you should have one of your substations built right back where it is now, so we're trying to get out of the floodplain.
Are you confident the Planning Commission will approve the plan?
Well, we need to be vigilant. We need to answer their questions, dot all our I's and cross all our T's, and hopefully we will get that approved and we'll move to the next step. But like I said, we're very sensitive to our customers' concerns about this substation, but we need to provide reliable power for downtown. This is a third of the energy that leaves our plant for the hospitals, the state of Michigan, the downtown business, as well as a lot of residents. But it's just unfortunate that, as the city built up around the Eckert Power Plant, and a park is there right over our distribution system, and that's where we have to land.
The utility has proposed relocating the Scott Sunken Garden. Where do you think that would go? How would that work?
Sure. We've proposed to relocate it on site, or if there's an alternate site around town, that we would be glad to move it there. We've actually put an endowment in to $40,000 to help maintain the park so that it doesn't just get relocated and not maintained. So that's just one of the many things that we're offering to do.
Now, the board also proposed moving the Scott House, which was moved to the site back in 1978, or to salvage what can be salvaged and then have it raised. Now, the board told Preservation Lansing that they'd pay up to $100,000 to relocate the building if a suitable buyer was found. Has there been any movement on that?
Well, to find a buyer, that goes through the City of Lansing's RFP process, but you're absolutely correct. We will pay up to $100,000 to relocate that house, and that offer still stands, and we're hoping that a site can be found.
Talk to us more broadly about the timeline for replacing the Eckert power station here. What's in your head in terms of getting? I know you've got a hard date by which that has to be offline, right?
Yep, that hard date is January 1, 2020. That date is not driven by any regulatory requirements. That's just when we'd like to retire the plant.
Oh, okay.
And the first step in that is to relocate to substations that is at Eckert so that we can continue our plan to shut Eckert down. But if that substation gets delayed, that can impact the closing of Eckert.
Are you still confident that the process will result in that substation being there at the site of the Scott House?
We hope so. We are fairly confident. We know that it is upsetting some of our customers, but there's also 100,000 people out there that rely on us to make good business decisions. So, I have to kind of keep that in the back of my mind, too. Mm-hmm.
Dick Pethley is the general manager of the Lansing Board of Water and Light. We've been talking about getting back to normal after the malware attack here about 10 days ago on their computer systems, as well as about the substation plan here that in Rio Town. Dick Pethley, thanks as always for being here.
Anytime. Thanks, Mark.
Coming up on Current State, Charlotte Public Schools have been considering doing away with the typical 12-week summer break in favor of a balanced calendar school year, and they may be getting closer to making a decision. We'll find out the latest from Charlotte Public Schools Superintendent Mark Rosecrans and Mike Bruce, president of the Charlotte Board of Education. That's on the way. Current State on 90.5 WKAR. Back in March, MSU graduate Mon Hamad came back to his alma mater to give a TED Talk about a very special trip. Hamad was born to Palestinian parents in the occupied West Bank of Israel, but he grew up in southeast Michigan. As a 9-year-old, he discovered skateboarding, and in time, what began as a hobby grew into a passion that ultimately matured into a mission. Mon traveled back to the West Bank last year and made a documentary film about skateboarding, Kickflips Over Occupation. Since then, it's been screened at the Ann Arbor Palestine Film Festival and about a half dozen other venues in Europe and North Africa. Now, Mon Hamad is skating into another adventure. In a couple of weeks, he's going to Lebanon to meet with Syrian refugees who might enjoy the sport, too. Kevin Lavery first asked Mon Hamad how much his Palestinian heritage influenced his American childhood.
It had a pretty large role. Arabic was spoken at the house. We always had Arabic food. We did Palestinian customs during the holidays. And during the summers of most of my childhood, I would end up going back to the West Bank to spend time with my grandma and see my aunts and uncles. But that kind of stopped when I was about 10.
Was that about the time you discovered skateboarding?
It was, actually. So I started skating when I was 9. That's when I got my first skateboard. The two didn't happen to just fall in place on purpose. It just happened to be I stopped going as much during those summers, and then I happened to pick up skateboarding in my neighborhood as well.
So when you did go back to Palestine for this visit that you chronicle in your film, which is called Kickflips Over Occupation, why did you go? Was it a family visit? Did you go by yourself?
I actually went by myself. This was the first time I went by myself in my entire life. I happened to graduate MSU in 2014, and I had a year off before I was going to start graduate school. So I wanted to just go back and support my Arabic language skills and kind of just travel after having been away from my original home for so long. So it really was just a kind of solo trip. I had the backing and support of my parents as well, obviously, but the trip for me was very different in the sense that it was by myself.
So I take it then you packed up your skateboard that you had been using for many years in Michigan and traveled halfway around the world with it?
That is true. I put it in my backpack on the top of my suitcase.
There you go. Right at the top, right where it's important, right?
Yeah.
Did you go over there hoping to spark some sort of a mission, or did you just figure, well, I'll just do some skateboarding while I'm over there, and you happened to discover that it was a very vibrant scene in Palestine?
I had no intentions of ever actually seeing skateboarders. For me, it was just I knew I would be bored sometimes in the small village that I was studying, so I just wanted some sort of outlet. Because for me, even in undergrad, I used to skate a couple times a week just to kind of relieve stress. So I knew that I wanted to just bring that. And when I was in the village is when I would randomly find these skaters, which if you've ever been to this village, it's a small Christian village in the West Bank. You're not expecting to see a skate scene there. So it was very surprising when I did. It kind of just fell into place. And that's when I was learning about the skate scene, and I would speak to these kids, and they would kind of give me their background and the background of how skating started and all of that.
We have a clip from your film. This is you explaining kind of the essence of skateboarding.
Skateboarding as a sport is very disobedient in essence. I mean, when you think of your prototypical skater, you think of a tenacious, strong-willed rebel trying to raise hell, right? Well, skateboarding in Palestine is sending that message. It's sending a message to the occupier and the world. It's a refusal of the status quo. It is showing that no amount of soldiers, no amount of checkpoints, no wall, no army can keep us quiet and in place. No one in the world expected or expects Palestinians to skate. So when a group of kids reveal that instead of throwing rocks at a clash with Israeli soldiers and risking their lives, they're instead throwing down kickflips in Ramallah, I mean, that's powerful.
So a very different mentality for a skateboarder in Palestine. Here in America, it's a sport, it's fun, it's a pastime, it's something that you're passionate about, but it goes to a whole deeper level in a place like Palestine then.
Yes, that is very true. I think there's a dichotomy between it. So the way that I use skateboarding is very synonymous with how they're using it in one aspect. I mean, they're using it to relieve stress and interact with their peers in one way. But for them, it's also this sort of resistance. The resistance mentality gets kind of grouped together with skateboarding because for them, it's so difficult to even get a skateboard. And it's so easy for them to kind of go into these different paths that are definitely violent and not so crucial to their lifestyle. I mean, they can go to protests, they can go to demonstrations, and all of these outlets are easily accessible for them. But for them to say, no, I'm not going to do that. I'm going to go travel to a different country to get a skateboard because they're not in my country. I'm going to do all of these tasks just to get a skateboard and hang out with my friends. I think for them, it's a call for resistance. And for them, it's a nonviolent way for them to seek this kind of more normal lifestyle that me or the hundreds of thousands of skaters in the U.S. kind of have.
I'm speaking with Mon Hamad. He is a Palestinian-American skateboarder who grew up in Michigan, born in Palestine. He is a documentary filmmaker who has made a film called Kickflips Over Occupation about the skateboarding scene in Palestine. Now, though, Mon, you are heading off to Lebanon in a couple of weeks, and you're working with a group called ANERA, American Near East Refugee Aid. How did you get involved with them? How did that opportunity come up?
So I'm studying for my master's right now in George Washington University, and I'm studying for international affairs. So the summer between my first and second year is an opportune time to kind of go get the practical training and skill sets that I inevitably will want during my future career. So I reached out to some people I know in the D.C. area, and they welcomed me to kind of partake in this volunteering experience in Lebanon, which is basically going to be an attempt to assist the Syrian refugees who have inundated the Beirut area and the Lebanese country. So it's kind of just an experience that I want to do to solidify my eventual career, and it's also going to be kind of the stepping stone into my trip in Beirut because I will be taking Arabic courses after the experience as well.
Is there a real difference in your mind between what you're learning in college versus what it's really like to make a personal connection with someone in another country?
I think that's definitely true. We spend a lot of time learning about international relations theory or economics or driving factors or indicators and all these key words that kind of make sense when you're writing proposals or things along that line, but the human connection is really lost when you're not on the ground and you're not speaking to people or realizing the lifestyle they live and understanding the bigger picture. And I think for me, when I went back to the West Bank, that was really a really important moment where I understood just one aspect. Like the story of the skateboarders really allowed me to understand a completely different side of Palestinian livelihood just from interacting with these kids.
Absolutely, and that actually transitions nicely, Mon, to the next clip I'd like to play. This is a few of the young Palestinian men that you interviewed for your documentary, and in this part of the film, you asked them what they think they would be doing if they didn't have skateboarding in their lives.
Absolutely nothing.
Nothing?
Just hanging out in the streets, doing bad things. Like, this is how guy, like, if, like, the youth in Palestine have a lot of energy, but nothing just to spend the energy on. But once they found their hobby or something to just to express themselves, this energy gets used in good things. But if he didn't find it, he uses it on bad things like drugs, robbing, stealing, problems,
protest
fighting.
Demonstrations.
Yeah.
So when you go to Lebanon, are you expecting to kind of run into the same perspectives?
I think the stories of these kids and these people who are fleeing are definitely going to be drastically different. I mean, in my eyes, I see skateboarding as a very positive tool for any of them. The outlet factor of it is very crucial. I think even if it's not skateboarding, having a positive recreational outlet is a priority, especially for people who are marginalized or feeling the sort of distress from fleeing a conflict zone. But I also think that the urban atmosphere of a refugee camp or a place like Beirut also is a really awesome place to get skateboarding started up. You know, the setting of where these people are going to be is going to be very conducive to having a lively skate scene. And the beauty of skateboarding is it's not only a group sport, but it's an individual sport where you're allowed to self-develop on your own terms. You can say, listen, by this next week, I'm going to have to learn this new trick. And it gives you the confidence and the self-esteem release and sort of just the wherewithal to forget. And I think that's very important for the situation that these kids are going to live in. So I'm going to bring my skateboard to Beirut, definitely. That's 100% going to happen. And I hope that I can stumble or fall in line with finding skateboarders that are there. And if not, I'm going to try to do whatever I can to support it.
Man Hamad is a Palestinian-American skateboarder who grew up in Michigan, and he's also a documentary filmmaker. His film is called Kickflips Over Occupation, about skateboarding in Palestine, and now he is set to go to Beirut, Lebanon, in a couple of weeks to meet with Syrian refugees who perhaps are also as interested in skating as he is. Man, this sounds like a great project. Best of luck. Be safe over there, and let us know how this comes out when you get back.
Definitely.
For Current State, I'm Kevin Lavery.
And coming up on the program, get your slippers ready. Cinderella leaps onto the stage with the Children's Ballet Theater of Michigan. We'll speak with the Okemos High School senior filling those shoes this weekend. That and more after the break here on Current State. Current State on 90.5 WKAR. I'm Mark Bayshore. We are glad you're here today. The timeless tale of Cinderella will have some spring in its step this weekend in a production by the Children's Ballet Theater of Michigan at Holt High School. The production, led by CBT's artistic director Gregory George, features a cast of students of various ages and abilities. However, Current State's Jamie Paisley was especially eager to speak with Cinderella herself.
I'm Brianna Renfrew. I'm a senior at Okemos High School, and I'm performing the role of Cinderella in Cinderella.
How long have you been with Children's Ballet Theater?
I've been dancing here since 2009.
Quite some time.
Yeah.
Do you remember your first role?
Yes, I'm reminiscing, and it's very bittersweet today because it's my last day in the rehearsal studio for my last show with CBT. But my first major role was Clara in Nutcracker 2010, so that was definitely my first big shining moment in CBT and one that I'm very grateful for.
And then what is it like working with Gregory?
You know, through the years I've been getting to know Greg, and so, you know, we're pretty close, but I love working with him, and he always tries to make, like, each role the dancer and helps you become the role of Cinderella. So he's been helping me ever since we started rehearsing in January. So
now, of course, the big question is, are shoes your normal thing in your personal life?
One of them, definitely. I love my shoes. The character is somewhat easy and somewhat sort of hard because the Cinderella character changes from the beginning of the ballet to the end, whereas the beginning she's being treated meanly and she has to just keep thinking positively and, you know, think about how to have courage and be kind and all of those things. But in the end, where she realizes, like, there is a better world and everyone can be nice to you, and she meets the prince. But going from, like, those two characters, it's not hard for me, but I just definitely have to think about it when just the faces in the beginning of trying to show the audience how really I'm feeling about not being treated nicely, and then actually being, like, so happy and amazed about everything that there is at the ball scene in the end.
Yeah, the emoting.
Yeah, for sure.
So have you read the original story, by the way? I know everybody knows Cinderella, yes. But have you, like, since you have become Cinderella, have you gone back and read it again?
No, I have not read it, but I've not. But I've seen, like, the movie side and the ballet, which they do relate but are different in some ways also.
What's your favorite other rendition? Because obviously your favorite right now is the Children's Ballet Theater version, but what's your other favorite?
Like movie-wise?
Yeah, or ballet, if you have a different...
I mean, I've definitely seen all the Cinderellas that have come to Wharton Center, and those are always amazing. And pretty much each ballet is the same for Cinderella. I mean, maybe the director will put in a little something of their own, but they all pretty much follow the same storyline. But I definitely do like the new Cinderella movie that just came out and the old one. They're both my favorite. Cinderella's my favorite.
Salagadoola, Menchikaboola, Bibbidi-Bobbidi-Boo. Put them together and what have you got?
So now that you're a senior and you're heading off, the question is, what is next for you?
I'm going to Point Park University in Pittsburgh to continue dancing. So,
what was it about that program that really pulled you in?
You know, just all the faculty members and everything that they have to offer. They have a tri-focus program, which is really nice. So they offer ballet, modern, and jazz, and I pick one to focus on. So I've chosen ballet, but then I'll also be able to study in jazz and modern, which is nice because now if you look at the dance world, it's changing. It's not just all classical ballet or all modern. It's all different styles, and, you know, if they want to hire you, they like well-rounded dancers better than if you can only do one style. So having the opportunity to study all three styles is really nice.
Have you looked at different Pittsburgh companies that you might be dancing with, or is that kind of forbidden as you go on to college?
You know, I definitely know the different ballet programs and different companies that are in Pittsburgh, but as of right now, I'm just trying, like, I've definitely looked, but I'm just trying to focus on kind of dance or, like, go to the college and keep just improving in my technique so that when I do go off my senior year to audition and hopefully be hired in a company, I know what I'm doing and hopefully they can trust me and count on me.
For this weekend's Children's Ballet Theater of Michigan production of Cinderella, I also spoke with CBT's Cindy Kangas, who wears many hats with the organization.
At CBT, I am not only a mom, I'm in charge of their marketing, and I am in charge of the ticket committee, and I'm also a board member. My daughter is 12, and she auditioned when she was 8. So, you know, do the math. This is her fourth year at CBT.
When it comes to Children's Ballet Theater moms, is there some sort of mentorship program that kind of ushers you in, or you just kind of step in where you're needed? You know what I mean?
You know, when you audition and your child becomes part of the company, you know, you have these meetings where they say, oh, you're going to be giving up, you know, a lot of your weekends. And you just think, oh, sure, no problem. And then you come here and it really is a lifestyle. You know, our daughters and sons are giving up a lot of birthday parties and school events to be a part of CBT, but the families are also giving up so much of their personal time to chaperone and be a part of things that are happening here. There are moms, you know, sewing costumes, and there are always dads and moms here painting props. Every weekend we're here. This becomes our family during the season. So, you know, as much as people try to prepare you, until you're kind of in it, you don't even realize what it is.
So if you've got a 12-year-old, then you've got several years ahead. Assumedly that this sticks, is that daunting to have that many more years in front of you?
You know, it's not. And I kind of feel that as long as she's happy and as long as she's loving it, then I would give anything to have her be here. You know, we it's kind of just our lifestyle. We made this choice and we love CBT. So, you know, I see the seniors and I see the moms every year when they leave CBT, and it's kind of mixed because they kind of feel this relief, like, oh, I don't have to be gone every weekend. But, you know, the tears of, oh my gosh, I gave so much of my life to it and I just loved being a part of it. So, you know, I'm excited to be here and I look forward to the years to come. Sometimes I watch Greg choreographing things and I think, what is inside of his brain? How can he put these things together? And sometimes he'll come to us and say, hey, I have a vision for this quirky prop, or hey, I really want the artwork to look like this. And we kind of all look at each other and think, oh, okay. You know, and there's a lot of back and forth. You have to really sit down and talk through things because he has these master visions and you want to be sure that you're interpreting them correctly. So, yeah, we let him kind of be the magic and come up with these wonderful, sparkly ideas. And then we try our best to interpret them. And sometimes it takes going back and forth several times before we fully understand his vision. Yeah.
What's the quirkiest one for the upcoming Cinderella production coming up at Holt High School?
You know, Cinderella, the ballet, is interpreted several ways. I think a lot of times everybody's used to the Disney version of Cinderella, but it's very classic ballet, and a lot of times the choreographer interprets it as they see fit. And Greg has done a great job of kind of playing to the parts of the girls that he has here. So he knows, okay, I've got a strong character here, so let's make this role a little quirky over here. Our Cinderella starts when Cinderella's young, and not a lot of stories start then. So you actually see the death of Cinderella's mother. You see the wedding of her father to the stepmother. And I think that's exciting because it's new and it's not something a lot of people expect. We have a lot of young kids in our company, so, you know, the forest scene is something that's kind of extended because we have a lot of young kids that are these wonderful forest creatures. So he kind of looks to see what's in the company, and that's kind of where he expands the roles and changes the story a bit. So it's just very unique.
The Children's Ballet Theater of Michigan production of Cinderella will be ready for the ball May 6th through the 9th at Holt High School. Tickets will be available at the door, but you can find more information about the production and the dance company itself at cbtdance.org. For Current State, I'm Jamie Paisley.
Well, no one can deny the appeal of a nice long summer vacation, but school officials around the country have concerns about the effects a long summer break can have on learning. Some schools have done away with the traditional school year schedule and opted for a balanced calendar that spreads that long summer break throughout the year. In Michigan, this has already happened in some districts, but not yet in Eaton County. Charlotte Public School officials have been discussing the possibility of making such a change since 2014. Here to update us on where they are in the process, Mark Rosecrans, superintendent of Charlotte Public Schools and Charlotte Board of Education president, Mike Bruce. Mike, welcome to Current State.
Good morning. Good morning.
Glad you're here. Mark, we know about concerns with the summer slide. Do you share those concerns?
I do. I feel like our students that over the course of June, July, and August, you know, upwards of 8, 9, or 10 weeks away from school is detrimental to their academic achievement.
Mike, do you tend to agree, or where do you stand?
Yes, I do. Yep, I agree with Mark. You know, I think that we've noticed over the years that we see that slide happening, and sometimes more than other years, but yes, it is there.
Before we get to other reasons for possibly embarking on this and resistance as well, Mark, describe what the school year schedule would look like if you went down this road.
Well, it would still be going into 16-17, 180 days of school year, and we wouldn't implement this, and this is a board decision for 17-18, but it would really have the school year starting early to mid-August, and then have periodic breaks throughout the school year, and some of them would still resemble what we already have in terms of Thanksgiving, the holiday break, spring break. But then the school year would extend a little bit longer into June so that we would be distributing the school year more equally over 11 months versus 9.
Mike Bruce, I know you've said you wouldn't want Charlotte to make the changes and be the only district who does it in the county, that it would be stronger for the county to make the move together. Why do you feel that way?
Well, I just think that we all need to be unified so that, you know, our calendar is on the same page. I think that it would be beneficial for all the school districts rather than to have one that's on one calendar and one that's on different calendars. I think it would make difficult decisions making and in how that we would approach that. So I would like to see all of us.
Can you give us an example? I mean, why if Charlotte went it alone?
Well, I think, you know, looking at scheduling for athletics, academic things that go on throughout the year maybe would be difficult where we're trying to do that with other members of the county where they're on a different schedule than we are.
Michael, continue with you. The board is meeting next Monday, May 9th, and I take it you were originally scheduled to vote on this issue then, but is that no longer the case?
Yes, we are going to table it until we have a countywide meeting. We're trying to schedule that. I know right now it's probably late June that we're going to get together as a county, all the boards, and discuss this.
Mark Rosecrans, have you heard from other districts at this point? This topic's been on the table long enough. You must have some idea of how some of the other districts feel.
Yeah, the other districts, again, each is unique to their communities, but like Mike just mentioned, the sentiments is to try to get a countywide meeting to allow the Board of Education members that represent both or all of those communities to really have a conversation about do they support this or do they not? Do they see the merits that this offers, or should they stay with a traditional calendar? And again, it's the Board of Education that will make this decision representative of their communities.
I'm speaking with Charlotte Public School Superintendent Mark Rosecrans and Mike Bruce, President of the Charlotte Board of Education. The district is considering a move to a balanced calendar. Mike Bruce, besides the summer slide, talk to us about some of the other reasons for moving to this schedule. I know the reasons have been put on the table involving at-risk students and other reasons. What are some of those?
Well, I think that we're trying to help kids that are struggling. It would give us an opportunity for us to have more time with those students when they have time off throughout the school year, to work with them to improve their academics and to give them some additional things that they may need.
Mark Rosecrans, to what extent do people who oppose this move have a case? I mean, what about the fallout from making a change, the negative fallout from making a change like this?
Well, like I've stated all along, I can see both sides of this concept. The majority of us in Michigan, parents and students, have always known the traditional calendar. And the traditional calendar has great merits in terms of everything that we do, you know, August through June. And it does, align with how we do athletics and the extracurriculars and the CTE offerings with colleges. The balanced calendar is the same in terms of the amount of school days. It just distributes them differently. And, you know, a lot of the feedback we have heard from our community is, you know, shortening the summer is a concern. The concern about our facilities being climate controlled for the August and June time frames.
Right.
And then how does it impact the athletics if other districts don't go to this? So You know, all of that has been shared. We've also heard from parents about childcare concerns, but I think the lens that we passed it through is what ultimately does it do for our students and their experience when they're here at school, academically, behaviorally, socially. Everything's been geared towards their success.
Mike, how big a factor is the lack of air conditioning in this? I know some school buildings are not equipped with AC.
Yeah, you know, I think that we can work through that with some alternative types of things short term. You know, I think that, you know, we're looking at it only being maybe two or three additional weeks in the fall. So I think that we will have to address it long term, you know, that we would have to climate control the buildings. But I think that we can do some things in the short term to make that happen.
Mike, how do you feel about this personally? I mean, is this a move you just individually would like to see?
Yeah, you know, I support it. I think that it's I think it's good for kids. I think my concern is do we have everybody, all the players on board, teachers and staff, the community, and those types of things. And that's what we're listening to and hearing as a board from our community and seeing what they want. But I personally think it's good for kids. I think it would be the right move at some point for us to do.
Do you think you're persuading people? I mean, people who have been against it, do you feel like you are beginning to persuade some number of those people?
You know, I'm not sure whether we are or not. You know, I think that we still have some work to do in that area to persuade people into it. I think we need to continue to show them the benefits for all kids. You know, and I think there are benefits for all kids. Kids at the higher level, kids at the lower levels, I think that there's opportunities for both of them. So I think that's what we need to do is show them those benefits.
Mark Rosecrans, how vigorously would you say you're promoting this idea?
Well, again, I presented the recommendation to the board in April, and their feedback was they really wanted to hear how the other Eaton County boards feel about this. So, you know, again, the boards are going to make this decision, and we're going to try to pull together that meeting in June and let the boards talk. I would say, you know, our commitment has, if we consider this, that we would use the 16-17 school year as a year of preparation and then move to implement this in 17-18. If the boards in each of the Eaton County schools don't necessarily align with that, it could be shifted out to 18-19. You know, there's really no reason to rush into this. This needs to be embraced by all the communities. And if it's not, then what are the roadblocks or what are the things that are concerning to those communities?
Mike, where do you feel parents stand on this thing broadly? Are they leaning in? Do you think they're leaning right now in one direction or the other?
No, I think they're pretty split right now from what we're seeing in the surveys and things. I think that there is a split, and that's a little concerning. I'd like to see more, you know, definitive one way or the other. But I agree with Mark and some of the things that he just said. So,
Mark, where's your faculty on this? You've taken their temperature broadly. What are you seeing?
Yeah, you know, our faculty is split. Our teachers, we did a one-question survey, and our teachers are kind of 2-1 against this, but our support staff is kind of the opposite. It's they're supportive of it. So, like our community survey results, they've been split all along because, again, it's a change in how we deliver the service. The days remain the same, but going from a traditional to a balance, there's some unknown there.
And if let me ask each of you to close here. If it didn't unfold this way, Mark Rosecrans, how would you feel?
I've been okay all along with staying with the traditional or the balanced. I can see positives and negatives on both sides of this. This is just an opportunity for us to really impact our students differently. I genuinely feel like the more connected our students are to the school, the better. And having that over 11 months versus 9, I just really feel like socially, behaviorally, academically, all of those aspects our students would be the beneficiaries of.
I've been speaking with Charlotte Public Schools Superintendent Mark Rosecrans and Mike Bruce, President of the Charlotte Board of Education. The district's considering a move to a balanced calendar. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And that's our program for today. Coming up Friday on Current State, a leading figure on the Lansing City Council wants the body to hire its own attorneys to get to the bottom of a generous separation agreement involving former city attorney Janine McIntyre. Council President Judy Brown Clark joins me to explain why. Lansing State Journal reporter Eric Lacey joins us in the conversation, and our Live Music Friday guest, David G. Smith, who's in town for an acoustic lunch performance at the Broad Art Museum. The singer-songwriter's new album is called First Love. That and more Friday on Current State. Peter Wharf is our executive producer. Katie Cook directed the show today. Thanks also to Scott Pohl, Kevin Lavery, Jamie Paisley, and Drew Hill. I'm Mark Bayshore. You've been listening to Current State on WKAR.